Pack Session number 12571, and this is Reel 4.
Admiral Hazlitt, Reel 4.
It was therefore was quite heavily patrolled, and it also had a current, strong current, coming out of it most of the time, a south-going current, so that it was very difficult to get in submerged. Your submerged speed and endurance were not enough to push your way against this current through the Lombok Strait going north. So you had to try and do it at high speed on the surface at night and hope you didn't get forced to dive, in which case you would probably be spewed out back into the Indian Ocean. We went first time on the surface. We did sight a patrol vessel, but we evaded it. Or we sighted something, I don't know what it was, but we managed to work around it and got through on the surface. We went along the north side of Java. We met a coaster escorted by a Japanese minesweeper. They were in very shallow water, but we surfaced and sank the minesweeper by gunfire, an action which we've got some quite good photographs of. I think you've probably got them in your photographic section. The coaster ran itself ashore. We hit it with the gun, but it was very long range, and I don't guarantee that it was totally written off. We then went on under orders from the American command to form a patrol line in the South China Sea, which was a protection for a landing in North Borneo by the Australians, a protection against the Japanese cruisers that were in Singapore. But we got to the Karamata Strait when one of these Japanese cruisers suddenly was sighted entering Jakarta, Batavia, that was behind us. And the Japanese had adopted a policy of pulling in their troops from outlying islands back to Singapore, and this cruiser had been sent down to pick up troops. It was sighted by two American submarines going into Jakarta, and we were told to take up a position north of Banker Island to try and get it. Now, this position was a long way out, and I was quite certain that the cruiser would, in fact, take an inshore route through the Banker Strait. So I went on in towards the Banker Strait, and there met another British submarine, an S-class commanded by Lieutenant Clarabutt, who was trying to make an interception in the same way as we were. We went close alongside to confer with him, and I realized that the best billet was actually inside the Malacca Strait, but that to get there you would have to pass a minefield just laid by a Dutch submarine. And I asked him if he would like to toss a coin for who would go into the best position. And he began to make excuses and said he didn't think it was a good place to go. So I said, righto, I'll go there, and left him outside. We then, next day, worked round the edge of the minefield and got into position in the Banker Straits itself, which was about, by my memory, about 16 fathoms deep, which was all right for British submarines. We're quite happy to operate in that depth of water, but Americans, they were much bigger submarines. They didn't like that depth. They reckoned it was far too shallow. However, we went in there, and the great advantage of this position was that the shoreline was within torpedo range on both sides, so you couldn't. He'd got to come within torpedo range if he came up that way, which we knew he was going to. That night we got a enemy report from American submarines off Jakarta again, saying the cruiser had left and was coming north. Whether they had fired at him and missed or what, I don't know. Anyway, we got this report from them, and that he had one destroyer with him. So we sat on the surface in the middle of this street, this Banker Strait, waiting for him to come. And the S-class submarine was outside the straits, in the entrance to the straits. In the middle of the night, the destroyer, the Japanese destroyer, had been sent well ahead of the cruiser, and we sighted him. But it was a dark night, and we couldn't see whether it was the destroyer or whether it was the cruiser. If it was the cruiser, of course, we had to attack it. If it was the destroyer, we had to evade it. So I let him get very close, and he came extremely close. I swung to port to keep bows on to him. He did, I've discovered since, sight us, but thought we were a junk, and he went right past. And as he was going past, of course, he saw what we were. We then turned hard to starboard to disengage, and he fired at us, but fortunately missed with his forward gun. And I fired a stern torpedo at him, and he turned away when he saw that. And we opened the range stern to stern, and we didn't dive. But of course, all the time I was then looking to see where the cruiser was. The cruiser, in fact, was a long way astern, and the destroyer then told him there was a submarine, and the cruiser, I don't know what he did, but he delayed several hours. We managed to evade the destroyer for the rest of the night. We saw him once or twice. And at dawn, we dived in the middle of the straits. And soon after daylight, the cruiser was seen coming up from the south, the Ashigara, hugging the Sumatran side. We were able to take a fairly deliberate attack from the middle of the straits. And as he passed, we fired 8 torpedoes, carefully aimed, and at a range of 4,800 yards, which is quite a long way. But we had his speed rev table. Intelligence has obtained this for us, and it's of interest that it was obtained by somebody at the Coronation Naval Review, at which this cruiser, the Ashigara, had been the Japanese Navy's contribution to the Coronation Review, and someone had very sensibly photographed or taken this table. And so we got his speed very accurately, and we hit him with 5 torpedoes out of the 8 and stopped him dead. The destroyer at this time was well away to the north. And had been attacked by the S-class submarine and was busy hunting the S-class submarine. The cruiser was on fire forward with a very heavy list to starboard, and she sank in about, capsized after about, took nearly half an hour to do it. And she had, I've learnt since, 2,000 troops on board, in addition to her crew of 600 or 700, and that some 800 people were drowned in that when that ship was sunk, the Ashigara. We did, before she sank, turn round and fire our remaining 2 stern torpedoes. But these missed, surprisingly.
So you fired 10 altogether?
10 altogether, yes. The last two missed. I think she still had some way on, and I assumed she was stopped. We then worked our way out around the minefield again, and we did put into the Philippines, which the Americans had taken by then.
What date was it that you torpedoed the Ashigara?
8th of June, 1945. And that was virtually the end of the war, as far as I was concerned. We went up to the Philippines. We came back down to Australia, in which minor things happened in the patrol. And when I got to Australia, I was told to fly home. I was relieved by somebody. And while I was flying home, they dropped the atom bomb, and that was the end of the war.
What do you feel are the main qualities required for a submarine captain in wartime?
It's very difficult to, when you put it like that. If I was interviewing someone, I would instinctively know. It's a very interesting position, because you live in a submarine in which, in the wardroom, the crew walk through all the time. The main passageway goes through it. Your conversation is probably public knowledge. You're very, very close to these people, to the remainder of the ship's company. You have an extraordinarily intimate connection. For instance, the man who works the periscope lever is terribly important to the captain, to sort of inch it up when he wants it, you know, and put it down quickly when he wants it, and to do all the rest of it. That man is a stoker. Now, normally, in a cruiser, shall we say, the captain would never see stokers unless it was Sunday divisions or he happened to go down the boiler room to look or something. But here in a submarine, there you are in intimate cooperation like that. All the other members of the ship's company you know completely. They are, of course, all experts in their own field. I mean, they may be a telegraphist as well as a submariner. They may be a man who's an expert on the gun. They may be a torpedoman. They may be, as I say, a stoker, an electrician, and even the cook, and so on. So they're all experts in their own way, as well as being knit together in this submarine crew. The captain has a unique position in the submarine, because in action he's the only man who sees. Whereas in a ship you've got many pairs of eyes looking through directors of guns and controlling the gunfire and making signals and keeping station and things, as well as the captain. In the submarine there's only one man looking. And one has to try and... people have got to have very great confidence in you, not to get worried. And they soon get to know you. I don't know, it's a very interesting business.
But if you met somebody at an interview, you would be able to weigh up from talking to
him. I'd give you a good guess whether he'd be a good submarine captain or not. Of course, they all submarine captains in the British Navy served in submarines for a good many years before getting command. I was 4 years as an ordinary submarine officer, doing every aspect of it, so you were pretty well versed in how the submarine worked and everything before you got command.
What was your own attitude towards the enemy during the war? The German enemy and the...
Well, You never saw him, of course. You never saw him at all. Unless you were taken prisoner or something awful. We certainly were not like the fuss there was after sinking the General Belgrano, when everybody was saying how awful 300 killed. We never batted an eyelid at drowning 800 Japanese, I can tell you. Never worried at all. There were very nasty stories coming out about their behavior in prisoner of war camps and other things. There were a lot of Japanese atrocities known against the Chinese, for instance, before the war, and we didn't like them at all. We were violently anti, and I really don't think... There was certainly none of this attitude you get nowadays of, feeling how awful should we have only fired two torpedoes and killed less of them or something. None of that at all.
And to the Germans?
Much the same.
Which part of your submarine war did you enjoy most, if one can use that word? In the Far East, or the Mediterranean, or Northern waters?
Well, there was no question about it. The Far East was by far the safest. We deployed, by the end of the war, very nearly 40 submarines in the Far East. And in the whole campaign there, we lost 3.
But was that because it was towards the end, or because it was the Japanese rather than the Germans?
Both. Both. And so the... Far East campaign was by far the least anxious of the three. In the Mediterranean, we sent into the Mediterranean just over 100 individual submarines, and we lost 50. And that gives you an idea of the loss rate there, which was, well, it's bound to be worrying, although I must admit that... You never had the same problem as men in the trenches, say, as soldiers, in seeing your chum killed alongside you. That never happened. The fact that whole submarines were lost, complete, didn't have the same impact because you were in and out of harbour, they were in and out of harbour, and sometimes you didn't see a particular submarine of your own flotilla for quite a long time, because he was out when you were in, you know. And when a submarine was lost, it didn't have quite the same impact. I must admit that when losses were heavy, you knew it. I mean, when you were losing a lot of submarines, you realized this, of course, and it was made you anxious, no question about it.
What was your attitude towards the other British submarine captains? Was it one of rivalry, or was it one of comradeliness?
Comradeliness. In harbour, they were your colleagues. The discipline was such that they were your drinking companions, and not, as a general rule, you know, they were your friends. And... one had slight rivalries, yes, unquestionably. But it was a friendly rivalry, I think.
Rivalry as to who could sink most?
Yes, indeed. But that was a very friendly rivalry. Sometimes, I have to admit, you looked down on other submarines and said, well, they're no bloody good, or they're not as good as we are. But not often.
What were your relationships with the surface Royal Navy? Was there?
Well, we didn't see very much of them, you know. We really didn't see very much of them. Submarine bases weren't often in the same places. The most I saw of them were in the Western approaches when I was the training submarine, when one used to go to wash-ups after exercises and things. I saw the rest of the Navy a bit in this North Russian convoy, but otherwise one didn't honestly see much of the fleet.
But what was their attitude towards the submarine service? Did they think...
Oh, they held us in considerable esteem, there's no question about it. And
because of the hazards?
Yes. I think maybe they were slightly jealous at the number of medals we got dealt out to us. Possibly, but they never showed it.
I don't know if you saw on television recently a German film called Das Boot.
Most certainly I did, yes.
Which represented the U-Boot campaign from their point of view.
Yeah.
I wonder if that struck you, did it ring a bell with you as to...
Yes, I thought it was an extraordinarily well-made film, quite first class. The actors who took the part of the submarine officers were marvellous, I thought, because when you think they must have been early being born at the time of the Second World War, they got it absolutely, and I thought it was extraordinarily well done. It was slightly overdone, but then you have to overestimate things, overemphasize things to bring the points home.
What type of things were overdone?
Well, I thought the sort of I was trying to think what it was. They were, I suppose the Germans were behaving more like Germans in a way that we never did.
How is that?
Well, do you remember in Das Boot the way they were fooling about in the submarine on their way home and things? Well, this
skylarking.
Yes, in a way which I don't think we ever never seemed to do. But a great deal of it was terribly well done. I thought it was the best submarine film of the war that I've ever seen, that Das Boot.
Was the insanitary aspect of it overdone?
Yes, that's what was overdone. Our submarines were never as insanitary as that, or never as...
With body lice and so on.
Well, I didn't think... I suppose they brought that out. It might happen on one or two occasions, but it wasn't a normal thing.
Did the way of going on in a German U-boat surprise you in any way?
No, I thought a lot of the things were very good, like when you saw the officers talking in the wardroom and that sort of thing. It was pretty realistic, I thought. I thought the captain and the engineer in that were extraordinarily good actors, first-class actors. It may interest you to know about the sort of conditions on patrol. People always seem to think that you must have a very claustrophobic existence. This never worried me in the slightest. One always seemed to have plenty of room. One has to admit that you were either in a submarine on watch or eating or asleep. There wasn't much else that went on. So although you slept in a large number of short periods, you got plenty of sleep. Exercise, I thought you got much more than people would think you would get. A vertical climb to the conning tower of 20 feet up the ladder, which you must have done 20 times a day or so, was really quite a lot of exercise. The routine of looking out, where you were swiveling with your arms holding the binoculars from side to side, it's very like physical jerks in some ways. And I never felt a need of exercise at all. One in home waters in rough weather, you got very wet. The bridge only being 15 feet or so above the sea level, you got drenched when you were on watch very often. And this was probably the worst feature. You did your best to be covered in oilskins, of course, and to keep it out, but it... And this was shown in Das Boot quite well of the sort of effect of bad weather. Early in the war, I used to take my shoes off when I got into my bunk. You, of course, were fully dressed in your bunk. You never took your clothes off. You took your oilskins off, but you were otherwise fully clothed. And I remember taking my shoes off and putting them alongside my bunk. The diving klaxon went on one occasion, and there was a rush of people past my bunk playing football with my shoes, and I couldn't find them, and I had to get into the control room quickly in my bare feet on the metal plates of the my feet got so cold they nearly fell off. I never took my boots off for the rest of the war. And I always kept them on and I slept in my boots and I suffered no ill effects whatever. And I got quite used to it and simply didn't mind. It had a great psychological effect when you were a captain of a submarine, when you were called to the bridge or called to the control room. You just put your feet straight on the floor and walked on, and it was much better than having to fumble to try and find shoes and things. I have to admit that I didn't wash much for the whole patrol. I, on occasions, had to have two lots of bath water coming when you came into the depot ship. And again, one didn't suffer any ill effects. Whatever. I found generally on patrol that things like coughs and colds were rare. Once you had become isolated from humanity ashore, you didn't seem to get them the same effect, same way. Of course, we were all very young, and this made it easier to compete with these sort of conditions. I don't think I would like it, certainly not at my present age. I remember a silly story, but you might as well have it on your tape. When we went to the Mediterranean in the trenchant, I can remember we left home waters in fairly not too warm. And the sailors used to wear those balaclava things to keep themselves going, keep them warm. And when we got to the Mediterranean, they sort of didn't seem to realize they'd got to a different climate. And I remember seeing a sailor